World. I'm John Batchelor. Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, travels to California to meet with other leaders, including the President of the United States and the President of Mexico. However, I'm told that the meetings were to turn on events that show companionship or comity or some de-escalation of the tensions between China and the United States, between China and Mexico, between China and the whole neighborhood these last months and years. Was it successful? I welcome Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State, and before that, a member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, based in Hong Kong before she came home to New York. So her vast experience on China over these last 20 years is most helpful, because China was not considered 20 years ago a predator state in the hands of a man who is regarding himself as a successor to Mao, but it is now. So it is odd to think Mao Jr. comes to San Francisco, a troubled city, to look for partnerships with the United States and its allies. For what end? Mary, a very good evening to you. First of all, Xi Jinping's mission was to de-escalate. Was it successful? Because what we heard afterwards was, you'd have to say, minor matters to do with promises made by China and no large settlement. Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, John. Well, I think Xi Jinping had several missions coming to the United States. The first and most important is to attract foreign direct investment that he desperately needs after single-handedly sending his economy into a ditch. And so I think the most important meeting that he had was with U.S. CEOs. Recall that foreign direct investment has turned negative in China. The Financial Times reported just in these last hours that more than three quarters of the so-called, the hot money that went into the Chinese stock market this year to date, 75% has left. So you've seen both long-term money and short-term money leave China. So that's number one on his list. Secondly, he wants to make sure that the United States understands that he's in control and he's in charge, and he is pushing Biden and Blinken to endorse his view of Taiwan. That was a change. It's no longer, oh, we both have different points of view. It's no, you need to affirmatively confirm that China owns Taiwan. And the third is to dispirit U.S. allies in the region by showing that President Biden largely ignores all of the other Asian leaders who bothered to show up in San Francisco. And instead, all of the media attention and time was focused on the Xi Biden meeting. So many goals there for the Chinese Communist Party leader.
And was it considered a success at the time? I read the headlines, they concentrate on Mr. Biden. But did Xi go home with a scalp or two?
Well, he certainly came home with a propaganda victory because he received so much attention. And I'm sure that the video of those U.S. CEOs standing up and applauding a guy who's presiding over genocide is going to be used at home. He may have succeeded in convincing investors like, for instance, Elon Musk and Larry Fink of BlackRock, et cetera, to stay. There were some very prominent corporate names there, Honeywell, Thermo Fisher, and others. So he may have succeeded in that vein, MasterCard, for instance. And secondly, he made promises to the president that he may not necessarily even keep. Recall that he promised President Trump a fentanyl deal several years ago, never came through on that. And in exchange, he's gotten China taken off some of the sanctions he eased on China, which happened immediately. So it's the old story where the CCP promises something in the future in exchange for gifts up front.
Mary, the story in China is not going in a good direction. It's going in a confrontational direction. Within these hours, for example, there's a story out of Australia of a Chinese warship deliberately provoking an Australian warship and putting a diver in danger, despite good communication with the Chinese warship. And the understanding out of the U.S. fleet, remarks by an admiral in recently, is that China's looking to provoke wherever it can in Asia. This doesn't seem to match that applause by the CEOs. So how do you discern Xi Jinping's presentation to the neighborhood, to Australia is the neighborhood, but also to the United States. Provoking armed conflict between warships is not going to get foreign investors to return.
Well, the names that I mentioned aren't leaving, John. And the CCP's strategy has always been to punch us in the face and see what happens. And if we don't do anything, they punch us again. And the behavior that they're engaging in with the PLA Navy and the PLA Air Force is incredibly reckless. And what would happen if, God forbid, an Australian or an American or a Filipino sailor or airman dies? I mean, that's a real possibility here. In that respect, I hope that the agreement that was made for basic military-to-military communications, that the Chinese side follows through on that. Certainly shouldn't have taken the premier of China to travel across the Pacific to agree to basic risk de-escalation mechanisms. But that's where we are. In the good news category, the United States has, in recent months, to their great credit, to the Biden administration's credit, you know, drawn the Philippines closer. We're starting to do joint patrols with them, air and sea, in the South China Sea. And we also signed an important agreement with Indonesia, a country, a very important country that abuts key travel lanes and shipping lanes that we have largely neglected in recent decades. So there are good things happening. But my fear is that we just don't have enough time, and that Xi Jinping sees a moment of opportunity, and that he'll seize it at a moment when the United States is engaged in not one, but two conflicts in Europe and the Middle East.
I tell a story that you reminded me of while speaking of the CEO standing ovation. It's a book that was published last year by an author, an English author, Charles Spicer. The title is Light, Coffee with Hitler, The Untold Story of the Amateur Spies Who Tried to Civilize the Nazis. I spent a lot of time with Charles and learned that he had fresh material. One piece of it, suggested by your recitation of the fact of this standing O, was an organization that in London was called the Anglo-German Fellowship. It had a German name in Berlin as well. And it was the major manufacturers and businessmen of London coming together with similar in Germany from 1933 onward to try to find an accommodation between the Hitlerite regime that was increasingly insane and the wish of the British Parliament to find a way forward so that we could all live together. That's what you reminded me of, Mary, because the first effort is accommodation. Business says, we'll never fight a war because that doesn't make anybody money. And here we have a model in the 1930s that is eerily similar to what we're speaking of right now.
Well, I mean, these organizations exist today to facilitate exchange with Beijing. I'm thinking of, for instance, the Committee of 100 or the U.S.-China Business Council. There are several of these organizations. And you're right, John. They essentially adopt the Communist Party line, which is let's just have quote-unquote win-win outcomes. Let's ignore all of the bad things that Beijing is doing to its people and to its neighbors. If we can all just ignore those things and make money together, well, you know, I'm sure it'll all work itself out if we have quote-unquote dialogue. Now, that might have been believable in the mid-1980s or the early 1990s, when there was still hope that this regime that was pulling itself out of a brutal civil war in which tens of millions of people were killed. But it's just not credible today, because now we have decades of history to observe China's behavior and the behavior of its leadership, most importantly. And we can see very clearly that they have no interest in changing their system of government or the nature of the regime or adopting all of the foundations that would enable and promote a liberal and free society. They have no interest in it. And I don't say that gleefully, John. It's a tragedy for the Chinese people. It's a tragedy for the neighborhood. It's a tragedy for the world. Because if China were free and its people were liberated, they could be an enormous force for good in the world. But instead today, in some respect, because we have saved them multiple times and enabled this brutal regime, they play the opposite role in the world. And that's a tragedy, and it's very dangerous.
A piece of positive information. It doesn't necessarily come to a success, but there has been an election result that surprises all the Americas. That is the election of a libertarian self-described TV personality, Javier Milei, to be the president of the profoundly troubled but resource-rich, well-educated Argentina, reversing the so-called pink tide of these last years. Can we hold on to this for as good news for 24 hours, Mary?
Well, I don't know, John. We're going to have to see how he functions as an executive. Javier Milei, I think, won in large part, not just because of his agenda, but because Argentinian voters were so disgusted with the Peronists and how they've destroyed their economy and the prospects for their children and grandchildren. He swept the election 56 to 44. It's the largest win since, I believe, the early 1980s. And the challenge he faces now is that he has a legislature that is largely populated by his political opponents. He only has a minority of senators, a fraction of the lower house under his control. So he enjoys the support of the former right-leaning leader, Macri. That's good. It's a good start. But now he faces the challenge not only of governing and pulling together coalitions, but seeing what he can actually push through into law. He has to work very quickly. He can't make that mistake that Macri made, where he sort of hedged and waited. And he'll have to maintain the support of the public. And so that's why I think you've seen statements like one that he made in these last hours, where he asserted Argentinian sovereignty over the Falklands. He called it non-negotiable, which, of course, immediately raised the hackles in Britain, because it is, of course, a British territory that Margaret Thatcher went to war over to keep. But that is a populist bent, an aspect of his leadership that will, I think we'll see a lot more of as he endeavors to keep that popular support on his side and exert pressure on the legislature to enable his agenda.
We're headed to Europe. Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.